The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network is proud to present The Orthodox Medievalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of history, a professional writer, and a priest of the Russian Orthodox Church. His web journal can be found at russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome to yet another edition of the Russian Orthodox Medievalist. And last week we were discussing something pretty significant. We were talking about the development of the national and nationalist historical idea in 19th century Ukraine. We dealt with Vladimir Antonievich, who has somewhat of a less populist approach than the dean of Ukrainian historians. And the dean of Ukrainian populism and a specific concept, the concept of national populism. Hudasevsky is the most important nation-building historian of Ukrainian life, became a politician later in his life, speaker of the Ukrainian Rada or parliament, and he became almost the official historian of the Ukrainian world. All nations, when they become self-conscious of having a specific identity, history, and language, specific take on the world, derives from their specific situation and their specific sufferings and what they've been through as a people, a group of historians come to articulate that in history. And all national movements have a historical basis. Nationalism is ultimately a historical approach to politics and political science. Now, the anti-nationalist movement will continually say, and they're officially funded today, that they invent history, that they force historical events into their preconceived ideological modes, which is, which is humorous coming from mainstream historians who, of course, do that for a living. But nationalists will say that, and I count myself as one of them, nationalists will say that these guys are uncovering elements of history that have been deliberately hidden and oppressed, suppressed by the mainstream. And that's what mainstreams do. Mainstream establishments, whether they be historical or scientific or literary, seek their own interests and will do anything in their power and everything in their power to harm anybody who has an opposing view and harm anybody who may threaten the integrity of the establishment. Bureaucracies have this tendency to begin to reference themselves. They have their own interests and their own purposes completely different than the purposes for which they were founded in the first place. And so the nationalist view of history is that these specific peoples are unique, have their own history, and many of the details of that history have been deliberately suppressed by the powers that be. In the Ukrainian case, you have two powers that at least at one time or another had an interest in suppressing that history. The Poles, who viewed Ukrainians largely as manual workers, as ignorant farmers who could never create civilization. And on the other hand, the Russians, who always had a high opinion of Ukraine as an integral part of the Russian Empire, and hence the problem. Ukrainians had always been overrepresented in Russian science, in Russian letters, in the Russian tradition. And that's part of the reason that the Russian Empire had always believed that not only was Ukraine a part of Russia, a part of the empire, but some of the central parts of the Russian Empire, central in a qualitative sense, central in that really the core of the Russian world can be found in Kiev and thereabouts. But of course, at the same time, the Russians also opposed any concept of nationalism, which meant that Ukraine would split away from the empire and develop its own culture. But let me say something in that regard. I've played, in my career as a historian, I've played a balancing act between the national claims of Ukraine and the empire of Russia. I've made the claim, and it's a fairly complex claim, that Ukraine is a separate culture. It's a separate culture for a whole bunch of reasons, not the least of which is that it was under Poland, Lithuania for so long, and lived a very different kind of a life, had a very different kind of oppressor than others did, than other Slavs did. But at the same time, the Russian Empire was, at least up till a certain point, legitimate. What was the Russian purpose in repressing the Ukrainian language, a separate Ukrainian Orthodox Church, etc.? The mentality was relatively benign, although the effects were not benign. The Russian government, at least in modern times, 18th, 19th century, viewed the Ukraine as an integral part of Russia. They viewed the Ukrainians as somewhat different, but sort of like what a Southerner would be relative to someone living in Massachusetts. We're all Americans, but we just have very different ways of living. But the most significant problem that the Russian government had with Ukraine, and Ukrainian nationalism specifically, is can Ukrainian nationalism be used by the enemies of the Russian Empire as a means of taking from Russia its most fertile and politically advanced area? When World War I began, for example, Tsar Nicholas II, one of the first things he did is order a major Russian infantry offensive into Ukraine to make sure that any element of Ukrainian nationalism was crushed. Now, Nicholas didn't do this because he hated Ukrainians and just couldn't wait to hurt them. Nicholas did this because he feared Austrian propaganda aimed at Ukrainian nationalists to pull Ukrainians away from the empire and then use them to fight on the Austrian and German side. For a long period of time, the Russian Empire was anti-Ukrainian only in the sense that they feared other hostile powers using a strong Ukrainian nationalist movement to use Ukraine essentially as a battering ram against the empire. Making matters even more difficult, Ukraine, of course, has always been the most literate of the Slavic Russian provinces. It has been one of the more religious of the, in terms of basic church going, even today, of all the older Russian Slavic Russian provinces, and had a fairly advanced industrial base, especially in eastern Ukraine. Even today, is one of the more advanced parts of Eastern Europe in terms of economics. So allowing a Ukrainian nationalist movement was tantamount to giving a major political weapon to whoever the Central European enemy was, whether it was Turkey or Poland or Austria or even Germany. As you know, at the end of World War I and even after the armistice was signed, occupied large sections of Ukraine. And of course, Hitler was also very interested in occupying Ukraine, given its fertility, and given its economic potential for the German peoples. This is a long-standing problem that Russia has. Now, we might have a problem with the ham-handed way that the Russian Empire dealt with its Ukrainian problem. It dealt with its Ukrainian problem the same way it dealt with its old believer problem, through force and violence and prison. It's easy to look back and condemn people here, and that's not really what historians are supposed to do, but we can say that there were so many other more subtle ways of not so much repressing the Ukrainian national movement, but guiding it and using it for Orthodox and pro-Russian ends, without denying ever that Ukraine is a separate, that they're a separate group of people, they should be given a great degree of autonomy. And the only time that any kind of repressive measures will be taken is if you decide to use your autonomy to support the enemies of the Russian Empire, Austria, Poland, whoever. That, of course, would have been far more rational. And it is the case that you did have pro-Russian Ukrainian nationalists, such as the old Ruthenians Austrian Galicia who accepted an Orthodox Ukrainian culture as a part of Russia, and yet still an integral autonomous entity. So you have, and you know, the Cossacks had always gone back and forth as to whether they supported the Russian side of things or the Ukrainian side of things. And the real determining factor in terms of Cossack history is whether or not the Cossack leadership had been given a certain plot of land or a certain title or a certain guarantee of political power from the Russians, in which case they'd be relatively loyal to Moscow or St. Petersburg, or if they were poorer. The poorer Cossacks had a tendency to support Ukrainian national and socialist orientation politically. But one of the ways that that St. Petersburg dealt with the Cossack problem was by splitting them at least in two. And that is to say, of creating an aristocracy. Queen Elizabeth did the exact same thing in Ireland, creating a native Cossack aristocracy that was given a tremendous amount of social respect and land and money and social standing in exchange for loyalty to St. Petersburg. And it's a common way of dealing with problems like this, simply splitting the difference. And so the Cossack forces slowly began to dissolve until they were completely destroyed, at least as an independent political entity, by Catherine II or Catherine the Great, who completely eliminated the Cossack host and brought it, absorbed it within the regular formations of the military of the Russian Empire. So we have a very complex set of problems. These problems, of course, are not really unique to the Russian case. You see this in various, you know, Scots versus the English, etc. You see this in different parts of the world. But I think there is a moderate view to take. I think a moderate nationalist can take the point of view that a Ukrainian who holds to the integrity and beauty of Ukrainian culture, and aesthetically, Ukraine is a particularly pleasing area, very powerful aesthetics. Aesthetics is at the center of Ukrainian identity, and that's relatively unique, I think. But you can hold to this integral Ukrainian identity without loathing everything Russian. You know, you can hold to an integral Serbian identity without loathing anything Ukrainian, Croatian. One doesn't necessarily imply the other. You could simply hold to the position that Solzhenitsyn held, that Russians should remain on their traditional ethnic territory, Ukrainians should remain on their traditional ethnic territory, with full respect to the achievements of both peoples. That seems to be the more consistent nationalist position. And the concept that Ukraine somehow belongs to Russia is not nationalist so much as imperial, and in fact has more to do with the concept of empire than it does any kind of rational idea of nationalism with ethnicity and religion at its center. So we're going to deal with Hrushevsky and Kostomarov when we return, and we'll be right back. Okay, dealing with the problem of Ukrainian history relative to the West, relative to Central Europe, relative to Russia, whether we deal with Russia as an empire run by a czar or as a national entity which centers around an ethnic group. And that's a subtle but immensely important distinction. Empires don't define themselves in terms of ethnicity. They define themselves in terms of a royal house, the dynastic point of view, and the Austrians were substantially big on this, and the official church. Those are the two things that bind the society together. And of course, as an aside, empire also brings nations and peoples together in terms of trade, and so an empire then creates sort of a free trading bloc that may not have come into existence if the nation was the only political entity. So, generally speaking, empires don't view themselves in national terms. They view themselves in dynastic terms, economic terms, and religious terms. But you can also view Russia or Austria or Poland as an ethnic group, not dealing with any kind of dynastic claim to universal power, like as the Mongols had, as the Byzantines had, that there's only one rational government, one single monarch over the whole world. That was the old Roman idea that had passed to Byzantium and eventually had passed to Russia, had also come into existence in places like the papacy as well as the Mongol Empire, that reason demands and natural law demands that there be a single global empire based on a single faith and a single idea. Of course, the nationalist movement vehemently opposes this. And that's what we're dealing with today. We're dealing with the concept of a national writing of history that does not seek to invent a history that did not exist, but rediscover something that had been lost. That had been lost because of the oppression of empire, the ignorance of the people, or whatever it might be. Now, last time we dealt with Antonievich, and we dealt a little bit with Hrushevsky, as the major figures in Ukrainian history defining a specific ethnic and national identity. And we did make the claim, and this is something central, I think, to all major nationalist historians in the Slavic world, as a matter of course, that there is a substantial distinction. When you're writing history, when you're talking about culture, make sure that you make the distinction when you're talking about the state on the one hand, armies and generals and bureaucrats and kings and queens. Make sure that that kind of talk is separate from the population as a whole. Family life, agriculture, how people lived, the religious consciousness of a people, this sort of thing. They are different from each other. And I have made the claim, and Hrushevsky has made the claim, at one time or another, that of those two things, the one with the least moral claim is the state. And this is a pretty controversial idea. Has national consciousness reached a point where the state is no longer necessary in terms of basic, the maintenance of basic internal order? Can an integral national entity, unified around a common experience, language, religion, culture, way of life, and traditional authorities at the village level, at the county level, are these sufficient to maintain order, or is the traditional state necessary? Because generally speaking, in national history, when histories are written from the point of view of justifying and legitimating the claims of a national group, as opposed to an empire, as opposed to world government, as opposed to the domination of money, as opposed to Marxism or liberalism, or other ideologies that oppose the national idea, is the traditional state absolutely something that has to exist? Now, what I'm trying to say here is that these kind of traditional historians, these national historians writing to justify a national group as opposed to some other ideology, they have a tendency to de-emphasize the state as a unit. That the state, if anything, I mean, at best, the state is necessary to protect the ethnic group from foreign oppression in the future. At worst, it's a parasite. It lives off the national capital of a people, but really takes without really giving. And that's something that all over European life has been a major issue. To what extent is the state important to the development of the national idea and then the actual manifestation of an independent Ukraine or an independent Ireland or whatever society we're talking about? Generally speaking, our national historians are very suspicious about the claims of the state, and it makes sense. It makes sense both in the Soviet era as well as in the dynastic era, because both of those ideologies make the claim that the state is everything. When you have the dynastic ideology of empire, they make the claim consistently that the state is the focal point of the nations and groups and peoples under its control. The state is everything in that case. And Marxism, of course, is well known. The state is allegedly the source of proletarian power, and therefore, whatever the state does is automatically the will of the proletariat, and therefore the state can do no wrong. But you have a similar concept in the dynastic notion, that the state really is almost a continuation of the line of King David in ancient Israel, and as a result, is the defender of the faith primarily. You saw that in Russia, you see it in Austria, you even saw it in Poland. You have these dynastic claims that are state-centered on the one hand and religion-centered on the other. So, when we deal with national historians, we're dealing with a group of people that are very suspicious over any claim of that the state might make. Because again, at best, it serves as nothing else than a protection of the ethnos, which is dominant. The ethnic group is dominant, the state is secondary, it is the defender of the people, and that's about it. Otherwise, it's a parasite on the people. Now, the concept that Ilyushevsky is building is justifying the claim that there is such a thing as a separate Ukrainian identity. This is the central notion. And the first claim, and I think we said this last time, the first claim is that the Slavs had always existed with some kind of highly libertarian state structure. The state structure was not imposed on them, voluntarily or any other way, by the Vikings from the extreme north of Europe, coming down the Dnieper River, looking for trading opportunities with Byzantium, which by far at the time, we're talking 700-800s here, the wealthiest city in the world. The claim of all national Ukrainian historians is that Slavic peoples had always had a state structure, but this state structure was basically libertarian. Now, the Moscow-St. Petersburg idea holds that the city of Kiev was destroyed by the Mongol forces 1270s, 80s, 90s, and up into the next two centuries. It was destroyed by the Mongols, and therefore the older civilization of the Russians centering at Kiev was destroyed, and those people then went to the forests of northern Russia to hide. They then helped develop the two successor states of the Kievan Empire, and that is Vladimir on the one hand, and then the successor state to Vladimir, which became Moscow. Therefore, the Russian historians are pretty much of one mind that there is a basically a rational succession after the sacking of Kiev by the Mongol forces in the 13th century. What we would call the Ukrainian people, that people on the borderland of the Slavic universe, or particularly the Orthodox Slavic universe, just bordering pagans of Lithuania and the Roman Catholics of Poland, Hungary, etc., these people eventually migrated north, slightly east, to help create the major dynastic cities of Vladimir and Moscow. Hence, we're talking about one people, we're talking about one development. This, probably of all claims, is the one that Hidusevsky and the Ukrainian National Movement will react against in the most vehement kind of a way. More than anything else, this is the claim that Ukrainian historians refuse to countenance. Here is Gudasevsky's answer here. First of all, at the time of the Mongol invasion, eastern Ukraine became a self-governing national and democratic entity. Only briefly touched by the Mongol forces, it became essentially almost a series of small city-states. That these eastern Ukrainian peoples essentially broke away from the princes. And that in places like the Galician Chronicle, we have some evidence that even after the sacking of Kiev, the Ukrainian people remained where they were and continued to develop their own civilization. If anything, what later became the states of Vladimir and then Moscow, 13th, 14th, 15th centuries, were mixtures of Slavs on the one hand and Finnish tribes on the other hand, hence creating a new ethnic group. And Gadushevsky points out, with actually quite a bit of justification, that the population of Vladimir, which just prior to the Mongol invasion became one of the most powerful of all the Russian states, remained a very powerful state along with Ryazan, that these became a mixture of ethnic groups, Finns, Letts, Slavs, eventually developing a hybrid Slavic identity, which we would now call the Great Russian people. Hence, we are not talking about the same people. We're talking about two very different groups of people that, from this moment on, will develop two very different civilizations. Okay, I'm out of time for right now. We'll be back in 1 minute.
Don't go away, because there's more on the Orthodox Medievalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Return to the Orthodox Medievalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, we've been talking about the historian Edosevsky and his response to the Russian claim that the Slavs living within the Russian Empire, we're talking, of course, Belarusians, Ukrainians, and Great Russians, are essentially one people speaking different dialects. The Ukrainian National Movement vehemently denied this idea, and then they made the opposite claim, that not only are we not one people, but we have created at least two separate civilizations. Here's the claim. Let me make four specific points. Point number one, that the civilization of Kiev, arising in the 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th centuries, this was a civilization that cannot be compared to what will develop later on after the Mongol yoke is loosened, 15th, 16th, 17th centuries in Moscow. They have very little in common. Number two, the difference here is only partially racial. But even if you reject the idea that the Great Russians are in fact a mixture of Finnish and Slavic, even if you reject that idea, it doesn't make any difference because the Ukrainian will say that given the political history of the two peoples, the evolution of both peoples developed two radically different points of view in terms of civilization. So even if they are of the same race, even if they are of the same religion, that tells us nothing from a moral, political, or cultural point of view. Number three is the big one. The schema that people like Edoshevsky will hold is that the remnants of the Kievan society, which, by the way, 9th, 10th, 11th centuries A.D., the most powerful society in Europe. The wealthiest society in Europe. Remember, this is at a time of severe decline of Byzantium. In 1204, Byzantium will be taken over by the Frankish crusaders from the west with the help of the Venetians. In terms of wealth, in terms of trade, in terms of literary culture, Kievan Rus was the most powerful society in European life, in that particular period of time. You had a highly literate society. You had a wealthy society. You had a society of overwhelmingly free peoples with a small slave class that largely was taken from POWs, of course, was traditional at the time. A great degree of trade. A great degree of trade not only with the Greeks but also with the Arabs. A tremendous amount of literacy and a rather extraordinary separation of powers between a monarch who was relatively weak, the town assembly, which was relatively powerful, Vietcha in Ukrainian, and then the church, which maintained its own center of power, its own wealth, its own court system. So you never had a period of time ever in the history of Kiev and Rus where one of these elements was ever strong enough to dominate the others. So you really had, I mean, you know, from let's say from an American point of view, had a highly progressive society, deeply religious, deeply literate, and very free, even in modern terms. Of course, Gudashevsky says that what will develop in Moscow will be the opposite of this. It will be tightly centralized, the monarch will dominate everything, and serfdom will be the main form of economic exploitation, rather than the free landowner or the free commune, which had developed in Ukraine. Which makes sense, of course, because Ukraine is so tremendously fertile. When I wrote the book, The Third Rome, elements of which I don't necessarily argue anymore, I made the claim that this may well be true, but that's certainly not the fault of the Russians. It's not the Russians' fault that they live in a territory that has very bad weather, it's very cold, and the ground is very unforgiving in terms of crops. As a result, very tight controls in terms of communal organization and serfdom were absolutely necessary to maintain a strong labor force that could always be depended on to till the land. You can afford a greater degree of freedom when you have the very fertile soil of South Russia and Ukraine. Not to mention the fact that the Russian Empire was always vulnerable to attack. It was vulnerable to attack from every direction, and as a result of this, you have the absolute necessity of creating a strong, militarized, centralized state that demands service from everybody. So you have a lot of problems. I mean, the growing season in most of Russia, as Moscow is becoming the focal point of Russian development, 14th, 15th, 16th centuries, the growing season there is 6 weeks. It is very easy to have a bad crop. It is very easy. Even a relatively small fluctuation in the weather can cause severe damage when your growing season is that short. The labor necessary to make that work is tremendous. So it's not the fault of the Russians if they've developed institutions, given their environment, which are not free. Now, Gudashevsky, Drahomanov, a lot of other Ukrainian historians don't necessarily make the claim that the difference between Russia and Ukraine is that of unfreedom or slavery and freedom. But given the reality of the climate, given the reality of the very different zones, climactic zones between Russia and Ukraine, the distinction is that Ukraine is associated with individualism, small family farms, while Russia is associated with a communal organization of labor. If you want to say free, unfree there, you could. It would be inaccurate. It would be highly problematic. But it's a difference between how you organize agriculture on the basis of a very bad weather zone, on the one hand, versus how you organize it in one of the most fertile places on the face of the planet, which happens to be Ukraine, the breadbasket of Europe, the breadbasket of the Russian Empire. It has the nutrients in the soil to feed the world if there was any necessity for that. Which, of course, might also explain St. Petersburg's great interest in making sure that Ukraine remained a part of the Russian Empire. It could not afford to lose its best soil and its most advanced peoples. So we're not necessarily talking about the distinction between free and unfree. We're talking about the distinction, more accurately, between an individual-based economy versus a communal-based economy, based upon the climactic conditions of the two societies, those conditions then created two different cultures. So even on the basis of climate, a Ukrainian historian can make the claim that we're talking about two different civilizations. But the counter here, I mean, here's the distinction. What Gudasevsky is saying is that we can't justify the old Russian schema that the Kievites went to Vladimir, Vladimir then went to Moscow. Hence, we have one Slavic family. No. They claim the following. Gudasevsky claims that the Lithuanian Chronicles and the Galician Chronicles hold that the population of Kievan Rus did not move east. They didn't move at all. If anything, you have complaints from Ukrainian landlords saying that labor is fleeing west into Poland, north into Lithuania. This is where labor was going, not east. There would be no incentive, according to Gudasevsky, for a farmer who is used to the fertile soil of Ukraine to go to the unfertile soil of northern Russia. Even worse, to a place like Novgorod, which, by the way, part of the Hanseatic League, one of the most wealthy cities in all European history in the Middle Ages. Novgorod had no farmland. It was all swamp. So there's no reason to go to the north. I mean, Novgorod was very dependent on outside forces for food, outside societies for food. It was not self-sufficient in food. It was a trading city-state, overwhelmingly, a very wealthy one, the largest and most powerful part of the Hanseatic League of Northern Europe. Novgorod is also a Viking settlement. Novgorod was also the home of St. Olaf of Norway for a short period of time when he was in exile. So it does have Scandinavian roots as well as Slavic roots, and very much a part of the medieval global Viking trading system. So you might even make the claim that Novgorod itself has its own civilization dependent on trade, given the fact it has no real arable farmland. It is a swampy mess. One of the things, by the way, that saved Novgorod from destruction from the Mongols. Mongols never touched Novgorod because the horses could not get through the swampland. Certainly were not interested in traversing that kind of a place. They forced it to give tribute, but never actually needed to invade or destroy the area. But what Gudasevsky is going to hold is that the Kievites eventually became the serfs, farm laborers of the Polish-Lithuanian Union. The serfs of the Polish-Lithuanian Union will eventually be mobilized by the Cossacks, which he holds as strictly Ukrainian phenomenon, and then that Cossack mentality will eventually lead him to the 19th century, where people like Gudasevsky and Antonievich built this national awakening. That's the chain of Ukrainian history. Completely different from the Russian view. So there are two ethnic groups here. The Great Russian group, which is largely a mixture of Slav with Finn, to create a Great Russian ethnic group, orthodox in religion, tightly centralized in terms of politics. On the other hand, the descendants of the peoples of Kievan Rus became serfs under Polish and Lithuanian masters, and they imbibed a completely different point of view in terms of politics, and that they were to develop not a centralized monarchy, but that this mentality from the Cossacks will create a sort of libertarian nationalist democracy. And this is what Gudasevsky will then advocate, not just on moral grounds, but also on historical grounds. Again, nationalism is a concept based largely on history. history then feeds into the moral idea. A people is a people and deserve independence because they have suffered and lived together for a long period of time. No different than a family. A family is bound together because they have suffered together. They've gone through thick and thin together. They have bonds that can't exist in any other format. They have bonds that come through centuries of struggle, for better or for worse. They form a people, and all of the Marxist or liberal individualist sloganeering can't change that. They might deny it, they might try to explain it away, but suffering is at the basis of these historical narratives. History is, in fact, a narrative. And that's the fourth point I wanted to make here. Gerushevsky's concept, and we'll find the exact same thing in Kostomarov, the concept is that history is not merely a chronicle of events. It's a narrative. It's a story about how a people suffered, how they also rejoiced, had good times, bad times, poverty, wealth, and how these things over the centuries created an extended family, speaking the same language, basically worshiping the same, and hence forming what we call an ethnic group. So the history dovetails with the morality in claiming that these bonds are absolutely essential for social cooperation. People will sacrifice for each other. People will even die in warfare for each other for the sake of these bonds. People do not go off to war with some abstract ideology in their heads. They go off to war with a very specific sense of their people, of their hearth and home, of family, whether it be the nuclear family or the extended family of the nation. These very concrete historical things. This is what motivates people to sacrifice themselves. Not some abstract ideology of individualism or globalism or the working class or some other nonsense. Okay. Let's move on in the last few minutes to Mihailo Kostomarov. He is another one of these major 19th century historians. Gerushevsky kind of bleeds over into the 20th century. But similar to everyone we've dealt with before, history is a story. It's a story of a living people. Kostomarov will make a name for himself by collecting, Johann Herder does the same thing in Germany, he will collect the folk songs of the villages. He says, if we're going to be consistent, if we're going to make the claim that history is about peoples and their stories, and that's how they define themselves, then it makes sense that I am going to go to the villages, and I'm going to ask them to play their stories, I'm going to tell them to give me their local poetry, their local artwork, because this is the stuff of real history. Not necessarily what a king does or what Napoleon does or what a pope does, but what the common people do, how they live, how they view themselves, how they view their people, their religion, in the greater scheme of things. So he will be the first major figure to travel the country and search out villages and search out their own self-identity, folk songs, poetry, religious practices, festivals, all of this kind of things. Russian history for him really is two things. We're talking about two entities. We're talking about a pre-Mongol and a post-Mongol world. The post-Mongol he calls modern and is Muscovite. The pre-Mongol is medieval and he calls Kievan. Kostomarov will hold to the view, though, that Moscow is the principle of despotism. Kiev, Ukraine, is the principle of freedom, democracy, and the national idea. This is not the fault of the Russians. This, if anything, and Kostomarov makes a claim, this is the fault of the Mongols. The Mongols have created this mentality. That the old traditions of Kievan Rus, of the Vyech, of the old church, of the old mentality, the kings that reigned but really did not rule, that is to be found only in Ukraine now. Moscow, not descended from these people. Moscow is the principle of centralization. Not their fault. History just dealt them a bad hand and bad weather. So this is not a moral category, but it is a fact given their history and given the Tartar yoke. Now, people like Kostomarov, and I've actually made this claim in the past, that the major peasant rebellions, the first under Tsar Alexis, the revolt of Stenka Razin, and the second under Catherine the Great, under Emelian Pugachev. These are major, almost anarchist Christian rebellions of the peasantry against the landlord and the centralizing monarch, in the one case Moscow, in the other case St. Petersburg. Kostomarov looks at these two major, they were civil wars, they had dominated, these rebel leaders almost came close to capturing the capital. These rebel leaders are in fact political and ideological throwbacks to the Kievan era. They didn't come from nothing. Their claims may have been very crude, but their source, moral and religious sources, derive from old Kiev. That in general, and we're going to have to wind up here, and I'm going to have to continue this next time, so we will have a part three of this. This is actually a very large topic, so I guess it makes sense that we will do that. That the Russian space, the Muscovite space, has always been multi-ethnic. It was multi-ethnic, centralized, militarized. But the way that he likes to schematize the ethnic background of the Slavic peoples living within the Russian Empire, he says this. He says there are basically four tribal identities, one based around Novgorod, very westernized, very European, very trading-oriented rather than agriculture-oriented. The second, the Lithuanians, that would include the Poles, by the way. The third, the Muscovites, and the fourth, the Ukrainians. These are the basic tribal identities of the East Slavs, of the Orthodox faith. And I think that's probably why he doesn't include Poland specifically, because they're overwhelmingly Roman Catholic. The majority of the population within Lithuania in the Middle Ages was in fact Orthodox, even though the monarch was at first pagan and then Roman Catholic. So, next week we are going to deal with Kostomarov. We're going to deal with the continued development of the national idea in history. And then we will finish up by talking about Galicia, and Ukraine, its history and development and political ideology. Galicia is the westernmost part of Ukraine, which was the nationalist center of the Ukrainian national revival in the 19th century. So we're really talking about the heart of the matter here and the heart of this program here. So again, we've gone a little long. I apologize to my listeners. I want to thank everybody. Everyone at the Voice of Reason, as I always do. I appreciate them. I appreciate what some people have been saying about me, and I thank you very, very much. Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Medievalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.